Happy Friday, everyone. I hope you're looking forward to a great weekend with your loved ones, your friends. Don't forget to include an assembling together with the saints at your home congregation. We all need that encouragement to love and good deeds, and we also need to be doing that encouragement. If you don't have a home church, go out there and find one. Get plugged in. Stay plugged in. If you are actively looking for a place and you're within driving distance of the Elkhart East building, please come check us out as a potential place to call home. Go ahead and open the book of Ecclesiastes to chapter 1, verse 12. I gave you a long introduction to this last time. I believe that King Hezekiah of the late 700s BC is the author of this book. Now, I'm not the only one that believes that. I found in my research that there were some rabbis that have come to that conclusion themselves. They are a very small minority that believe that, but they had their own reasons similar to the reasons I give. And that is that Hezekiah was Judah's best king. And he was faced with a life crisis, probably in his 30s, facing death. And God gifted him another 15 years. But it didn't change the fact that he was going to die. And I think as time went on, closer and closer to his death date, that bothered Hezekiah. That he realized that death is inevitable. No matter how good you are, no matter how much you know, no matter how much you do, you're still going to die. And so I think he wrestled with the meaning of life and the inevitability of death. And having done so, he then sat down and wrote this book. I think this is a life crisis journal. And as we go through it, we're going to see a lot of pessimism, a lot of futility, a lot of depression, but mixed in there with that, because those are his real emotions that he's just putting out there for everybody to see. But mixed in the middle of that is the conclusion he eventually comes to, and that is, yes, there's nothing we can do about death coming, but we must remember that we are going to answer to God for what we do with life, and so we ought to make the most of it. And so this is a great book for people that are workaholics, to learn not to be that way. You've got to enjoy life more. And for those that are maybe too lazy, the sluggards that we saw in the book of Proverbs, because you need to do something to make a difference for your life and the lives of the people around you. That's the gift of life, is to make a difference. And so, doesn't matter where you fall in that spectrum, this is a great book for you. Doesn't matter where you're at in your lifespan, whether you're at the beginning, middle, or end, this is a great book for you. So let's pick back up at verse 12, where Hezekiah, Koholet is the name he uses for himself, which the English Standard Version consistently uses preacher because they're focused on the Greek Old Testament's use of Ecclesiastes. But I think it's more focused on the idea of the collector, the person that collected people, the person that collected wisdom, the person that collected things. Okay? Verse 12 of chapter 1. I, the collector, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I applied my heart, that is, my decision-making capacity, to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under the sun. So he says, I decided to use my intellect to seek out all the information out there, the wise information, which we know that Hezekiah was interested in the book of Proverbs. I decided to do that so that I could find out all I could about life on planet Earth. And then he said this, it is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Now, the word unhappy here is a word that he uses quite often, but the English Standard Version, other English versions, give it different English words. It's the idea of something that's bad, something that is, well, not happy bringing, rotten, makes you feel horrible, okay? And so he's saying here, God has left us with a rough situation, which is a reference to life in this fallen world. Sin brought with it the curse. That curse brought physical death, but it also brought hard work, repetitive work, weeds and thorns and thistles and accidents and the free will negative actions of other people, all of that. And so God is letting it all play out. And that is our lot in life. That's tough. And that's what we stay busy with as we go about the work that we have to do in order to continue living. Verse 14, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. Don't think uselessness when you see the word vanity. The word literally has to do with a puff of breath. And it's focused on the idea that there is nothing permanent about that puff of breath. There is nothing lasting. There is nothing that can be kept by our efforts about that. And that's brought up in the synonym, the striving after wind. You know, none of us can reach out there and grab the air and hold on to it. You know, stuff it in a jar and save it for later. Yes, I know some of you say, oh, but we can take oxygen and we can stuff it in a tank and use it. Yeah, I suppose you can, but you're still going to use everything up that's in that tank and it'll be gone. And then you'll have to go out and find more, because that's the reality of life, is it's always fleeting. It's moving forward and leaving us behind. This is where we kind of ended up. What is crooked cannot be made straight. You know, there are certain things in life that we'd like to make it be back to the way it was, and we don't have the wherewithal to do it. And what is lacking cannot be counted. That's the idea that no matter what we know or even think we know, there's still more out there we don't know. You can't ask somebody to count something that's missing, because they don't have how many there were to begin with or how many that have been found. They don't have enough information. And that's life. We don't have all the facts. None of us do. So back to the text now. I said in my heart, so in my thinking place, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. Now, this is the reason why a lot of people look at this book and say, oh, this is Solomon that wrote this. And my response is, no, I think it's the next wise guy in the sequence of those that ruled at Jerusalem. I think it's Hezekiah, because he was the next big wisdom seeker amongst the kings at Jerusalem. And he was a better man than Solomon. morally, and with his conclusions from gathering wisdom. Verse 17. And so I applied my heart, my thinking process, to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. Now, madness and folly should probably be teamed up here in our head because they are both opposites of wisdom. Wisdom is not just intellect. Wisdom is knowing how to use that information appropriately from God's standards. See, there are a lot of smart people in the world that know a lot of really intellectual things, but they don't use it properly according to God's standards. And that's not good. That actually is the idea of madness and folly. They're synonymous with the idea of being foolish. And we've talked about this idea of foolishness in the Bible is represented by this psalm. A fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So a fool rejects ultimate divine authority. And because of that, really kind of rejects all authority. Doesn't think the rules apply to them. They think they're the ones that get to set the standards. They get to set the rules. And so madness and folly are rebellion against God's structure, against God's creation, against God's design and will. And so what Hezekiah, I think, is saying here is, I went out there to figure out both sides of the story. Wisdom, and then everything that's opposite of wisdom. Because sometimes we understand one thing by looking at its opposite, right? Every time I am looking at a thesaurus for synonyms, almost always, right there in the entry, there are antonyms as well, opposites, to help us understand better what the word means. Okay? So he goes out there and does that, and he says, I perceived that this also was but a striving after wind. So even trying to understand the full spectrum from wisdom to foolishness, I was trying to catch wind and hold it. And it doesn't work. For in much wisdom is much vexation, irritation, frustration, if you will. Because he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. And he will make this very clear later. The more you know, the more you know you don't know. The more you know, the more you wish you didn't know. Because once you know it, you can't unknow it. And so, the smarter you are, the more frustrated you can become. First, because you know stuff you wish you didn't know, but also because you know you still don't know enough stuff. That's why getting smart is not the solution to the problems of life. Yeah, it might help alleviate some of the problems here and there, but it doesn't fix it. Chapter 2. I said in my heart, come now, I'll test you with pleasure. Just enjoy yourself. So in his pursuit to make sense of life, in the view that death is coming, he does what a lot of people do, and that is, well, just forget about it. Let's just make the most of life right now by partying down. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, right? You only go around once in life, so grab for all the gusto you can, right? I mean, that's the philosophy of a lot of people. And so he apparently thought, yeah, let's try that. But he acknowledges, because this is his journal, this is him writing it down after he's been through the whole process. But behold, this also was vanity. It was a puff of breath. It didn't get me anywhere. I said of laughter, you know, laughing about this, that, and the other thing. It's just mad. It's just mockery. It's just making foolishness. We have in our society a lot of stand-up comics. And almost always, when you delve into their life story, you find out that they used humor, laughter, to deal with their own bad life situation. And it didn't fix it. It helped manage the pain a little bit, but it didn't fix it. So, yeah, try to laugh it off, but it's just craziness to think that that's going to fix it. So he said of laughter, it's mad. Of pleasure, the idea of just trying to be happy with what you got. What use is it? So having stuff isn't going to fix the problem either. He'll make a really big point of that later. I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with mine, with wine. My heart still guiding me with wisdom. So I want you to pay attention here. He is not saying he's going to go out and get drunk. What he does is what a lot of wealthy people do, intellectual people do, and that is they take to wine tasting and collecting different vintages. And it's not about drunkenness. It's about the flavor. It's about the experience of the look and the smell and the taste. And so he says, you know what? I decided to become a wine connoisseur. With my heart, my thought process still guiding me with wisdom. So I'm going to try that. And how to lay hold of folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. So I decided to experiment. Yeah, a little bit with pleasure here and pleasure there, and I tried to be goofy from time to time. I became a wine connoisseur, and I thought about these things to try to make the most of my life, and where did it get me? Verse number 4. He's still describing things that he did during this phase of just trying to be happy with stuff. And this is another place that really matches the life of Hezekiah. Some of the things described in here are exactly what we saw described in 2 Chronicles chapter 32 about Hezekiah. I made great works. I built houses. And I planted vineyards for myself. Well, yeah, if he's going to become a wine connoisseur, of course he's going to plant his own vineyards. I made for myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. So he makes these nature preserves with fruit trees of all kinds, orchards all over the place. He probably experimented with cross breeding of different types of fruit trees. And it's a beautiful place to walk. It's a beautiful place to smell and taste. I made for myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. So he makes big reservoirs. And of course, the water is needed to water, to irrigate all of these new gardens and parks. But you know what? You can do a lot of design work even with the pools themselves. You know, the way they're shaped. Or maybe you use a little bit of that gravity pressure in order to make some fountains here and there. And then maybe you can put some fish in or keep some ducks and geese around and make it beautiful, right? all of us understand where he's going with this. And a lot of wealthy people have done this. My wife and I were stationed in Europe, in England, and we went to a lot of different palaces, and we saw what rich people did, where they tried to make themselves happy. And one of the things they liked to do was surround their palaces with beautiful parks, with beautiful orchards and fountains and plantings and animals. And that's what this guy's talking about here. That's what King Hezekiah is saying he did. Verse 7, the word is actually acquired, and so I kind of object to this being focused on the idea of slavery here, because remember, we're talking about the context of Israel. And Israel's intention by the law was to make sure that Israelis did not become slaves. If you saw one of your family members or one of your acquaintances going into debt, you were supposed to buy up the debt and take them on as a temporary servant. Nobody could be kept as a servant longer than the 6 years of the work cycle in Israel. And so I think that our English Standard Version translators, along with other English translators, have kind of stepped too far in the application of the word slave here. The word is also appropriate for servant, somebody that is hired for a job. Okay? And so that's the way I'm going to read it. So I acquired male and female servants. And I had servants who were born in my house. So, you know, you have a staff that's working for you, and they have kids. And so you hire those kids. This happened in English households all the time. And so that's what he's describing here. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. And that seems to match exactly what's in 2 Chronicles. Let me just read again. Pens for all kinds of cattle and sheepfolds of the flock, right? He made cities for himself, acquired flocks and herds in abundance, for God had given him very much wealth. So 2 Chronicles 32 seems to match exactly what we're seeing here. Verse 8, back in our Ecclesiastes 2. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. So he's filthy rich because he is a very prosperous king. Therefore, his people are very prosperous. And so everything's going well. And then we come to the last part, which I want to tweak the English translation a little bit again. I got singers, both men and women. And so today we have electronics. And so when we want music, we used to just put on a record or an 8-track or a cassette tape or a CD. Nowadays, everybody's got the streaming services and you just bring it up on your app. Back at this time, they actually hired the people to be present and do the singing. And so when you're filthy rich, like a king, you actually have on staff singers and musicians. And that's what he did. And so he had music all the time that he wanted. So I got singers, both men and women. And then many concubines. Now, it's interesting, our English Standard Version that we're using puts a footnote at this point, appropriately so, the meaning of the Hebrew word is uncertain. Now, I wish that those who did the translation would therefore be more thoughtful about what the Greek Old Testament says at this point, because the Greek Old Testament is pretty clear. It says that this is talking about wine stewards, wine waitresses and presumably waiters. Now, we already talked about the idea that he was going to become an aficionado of wine. He was going to become a wine connoisseur. And so the picture is, I believe, in the original language here, that not only did he have singers, but he also had an entire staff that was devoted to helping with his wines, to keep them, to gather them, and to serve them with the appropriate complimentary meals, both men and women, as his waiters and waitresses. And then he follows all of this up with the delight of the sons of man. This is the sort of thing that can make your life very happy. But this is what he found. Verse 9, so I became great, surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Keep that in mind. He's always being guided by wisdom. And whatever my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. So all his hard work, all the things that he just described doing. Remember, he didn't go into hedonism. He didn't go wild here. He basically just tried to make himself happy and distracted with all the good things that are available in life. And he found that it was pleasant. But he also found this, verse 11. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity. All was a puff of breath and a striving after the wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Meaning, but I was still going to die. I had all this stuff, but I still was going to die. Mark your place. We'll get back here next time. We're into the Word.